Imploding old resorts has become a fact of Las Vegas life. But before there were mega resorts along the Strip, there were casinos downtown. And even though we often think of some of those properties as old and tired, many only go back as far as the 70s or 80s. If you're interested in what used to be downtown or along the Strip before the 1990s remade Las Vegas into a luxury destination, you'll find a lot to think about in Jeff Burbank's new book, Lost Las Vegas. It's a large format book with photographs of Las Vegas past on every page, and Burbank has provided a brief history of all the establishments that have passed into history. Jeff Burbank will be signing books tomorrow at noon at the Costco store in Henderson, and he joins us now. Jeff, welcome back to KNPR.
Oh, thanks a lot, Dave.
This must have been quite a winnowing out process. I mean, there's so much of Las Vegas's past over the last 75 to 100 years or so. How did you go about selecting the lost parts of Las Vegas to appear in the book?
First of all, it was what pictures we could obtain. So we had a long, long list, about 125, 150 different places. And then they started researching photographs, and they just couldn't find some of the things on there. So we just keyed on the major names first. And then we found some things as we were searching, you know, the Elvis-O-Rama Museum and things like that. So it's kind of the minor stories too.
Was there anything you wanted to write about but couldn't find photos for, or at least couldn't get photos that would work in the book?
Well, there was the Riverboat Casino that was later became Harrah's. I couldn't find much on that, but it was really not that difficult. You know, we found a lot of photos in the Library of Congress, also UNLV Special Collections, but Getty Images and Corbis Images. What I liked is that they were able to find a number of photos that I hadn't seen before.
Are you telling me, though, that you got, in a way, you got scooped by these British researchers in some of these photographs? I mean, you know, you got this encyclopedia of Las Vegas in your head. They must have gotten very lucky.
Well, I saw a lot of photos. For instance, I helped put together the online Nevada collection from UNLV's Special Collections, you know, photo collection. And so I was able to scan a lot of those images and send them up to Reno. But a lot of these images here I hadn't seen before. When the dunes opened, there was a picture of a young Jane Mansfield next to a roulette table, and I'd never seen that. There was this interesting picture when the El Rancho Vegas opened, and you see it's a promotional picture. You see this woman pulling a lever on a mechanical slot machine, and nickels are falling out, and there's a someone in the military next to her, and then there's another couple there, and that's a full page picture, color picture. Mm-hmm. Also, the Royal Nevada Hotel, which was put together Frank Fishman in the mid 50s, and designed by Paul Revere Williams, the African American architect who also designed the La Concha. But there were pictures of that facade of the Royal Nevada with these tiered fountains, and that makes an interesting addition to the collection. And then you see the two crowns that Williams designed, one on top of the front sign and then another on top of a two-story tower at the porte cochere of the hotel.
Now, a lot of us, I guess, would tend to think of Las Vegas as we know it really starting to blossom after World War II, late 40s through the 1950s, kind of the atomic age. But you also write about a number of the original casinos or clubs downtown on Block 16, the Arizona Club, the Boulder Club, and they were operating before gambling was legalized in the 1930s, when this was just a tiny, tiny town. Tell us about them.
After Las Vegas was created, they built one specific area, was blocked off, Block 16, and that was where all the gambling and drinking was supposed to be done. And an entrepreneur named James McIntosh began the Arizona Club in 1905, right away when they were selling plots of land downtown. And he really created the best club in Las Vegas. It was a couple blocks from the train station, so people who were there just sort of at a rest stop could walk a couple blocks, go to the Arizona Club, have a few drinks and get back on the train. It was also the best local gambling joint. And then, of course, it sort of became a house of prostitution in the late 30s, and the town finally closed it down in 1941 when the military said that they didn't like their troops going there.
Now, one downtown hotel that is not around anymore is the Mint, but it was a big name in its day. What was special about the Mint Casino?
Well, the Mint had some awesome casino signs. It's probably one of the best ever. This sort of a flowing, curved sign that would go up and down. And it was really a beautiful part of downtown in the 50s, and a real memorable one. It didn't do very well on the casino side, and eventually it was acquired by the Binion family. But also, great thing about the Mint, too, it had its tower with a cocktail lounge on the top and a restaurant, and great view of the whole city.
And when a lot of us who grew up reading Hunter Thompson got to know the Mint 400, that was kind of the whole reason for what became the book Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It used to sponsor that. Now, why didn't it do that?
Well, it was a great idea to promote the hotel casino, and it was a fabulous success. Unfortunately, it wasn't necessarily a lasting success for the Mint.
Resorts during this time, the 1940s, began to appear along the Highway 91, kind of heading out of town on the way to Los Angeles. And now, of course, it's the Strip. One of the places on the road was the Club Bingo, which Club Bingo deliberately highlighted its bingo parlor, but it also became famous for its nightlife.
Right. The Club Bingo was started by Milton Prell, who was a very famous figure in Las Vegas casino history. He started it in 1952, and it was an interesting concept. You had this bingo card that was a neon bingo card, and it would change. The numbers would turn off and on as if the bingo numbers were being called. And there is a picture in the book, too. It shows that it would light up in all in blue at night. So that would eventually morph into the Sahara, which would become a much more famous hotel casino that Prell put together.
Now, one of the early innovators and one of the more famous early resorts in Las Vegas lore post-war was El Rancho Vegas, and it was thought of as a great innovator along the Strip. What were the kinds of innovations that El Rancho Vegas came up with?
Well, El Rancho Vegas, I mean, there's a picture in the book where you can, it's an aerial picture, and you can see that there was a shopping mall in the rear, which was very interesting. That was unusual. And then there was a gas station on the side, which right next to the Strip in a corner of the property. This was started by Thomas Hall, of course, in the early 40s. And this is that, I mentioned that picture of the color photo of the woman pulling the slot machine arm with the guy in the military posed. That is a very interesting picture to promote that casino in the 40s. It was famous for the fire that destroyed it in 1960. Mysterious fire still has not been solved.
We're talking with author Jeff Burbank. His new book is Lost Las Vegas. It features many photographs of historic casinos and other places that are no longer here, like the El Rancho Vegas. Jeff Burbank will sign copies of his book tomorrow at noon at the Costco store in Henderson. We can move forward, I guess, into the atomic age in the 1950s and early 60s, when there was a huge wave of construction. And a lot of it involved money from the Central States Pension Fund. One of the more famous casinos, resorts, was the Desert Inn. Talk a little bit about Wilbur Clark.
Wilbur Clark started out as a hotel worker. He was a pretty smart businessman. He was able to buy interests in casinos in the 40s. He had this idea of building the best casino in town, better than the El Rancho and the Last Frontier. And he did get started and put together a pretty good project at first, but then he ran out of money and it sort of sat there for a year and became kind of a local joke. But it's really desperate for money, he got the members of the Cleveland mob, including Mo Dalitz, to give him some money to finish construction. And then, of course, they received a large share of the operation. And they actually moved to Las Vegas Mo Dalitz and his partners.
Now, eventually, the Desert Inn gets a very, very famous resident right up at the very top. And that's, I guess, that brings in the Howard Hughes era, doesn't it?
Right, the Howard Hughes era. Howard Hughes used to come to Las Vegas in the 40s. He would fly planes here. He was a regular at the Sahara in the early 50s. He was a slot player, a beer drinker. When he made more than $100 million on selling his TWA company, the stock in that, he was in town. He was staying at the Desert Inn and decided to buy the hotel and started buying other hotels he could see from his penthouse there, and really, really changed the town.
Talk a little bit about the photographs of the Desert Inn, because you've got there's a transformation that goes on. It's with so many of the famous kind of old line resorts. Desert Inn was one of them for many years. Tropicana was another. The Flamingo is another. They really have changed over time, haven't they?
The Desert Inn was one of the most famous casinos, of course. The book has an aerial view of the casino. There are some good photos of the pool in the rear with the tower there around 1950, and some postcards showing the hotel in its heyday.
You've also got accounts of a hotel that's not actually lost, if you will. It was when it was first put up known as the MGM Grand, although it's now known as Bally's. It was the first hotel, you say, on the Strip to rival Caesar's. What was different, it's so special, about the MGM Grand in its first incarnation?
Well, I mean, just the scope of it, the number of rooms it had. I mean, it had two showrooms. It opened in 73. It really outdid the Caesars in a number of ways. I mean, for instance, the two showrooms it had, he opened it at Kirkorian, where he had Barbra Streisand in one showroom and then the Broadway cast of Hair in the other showroom at the opening of the casino. The thing is with that, that led to that tragedy where you had in 1980, where you had 85 people killed in a fire. They found out that, you know, while they were building it, they just didn't put in enough safety features there. And the suggestion was that they were probably building it maybe a little too quickly, and there wasn't enough local oversight on the building process.
That process changed after the fire.
It did. It changed state law, and so precautions are put in new buildings.
Now, another very well-known hotel you have is the Silver Slipper, and it's pretty famous in the annals of Las Vegas entertainment. What did they do that was so distinctive, so special?
Well, you know, I went to the Silver Slipper before it was torn down, and it was kind of like a time travel. You could see what a place like that looked like in the late 40s. It was basically a room where you had a stage, a relatively small stage, and then a bar to the left, and then you had places for people to sit and tables. And it was real interesting to be in there. It became famous in the 50s for strippers. Sally Rand, the famous stripper from the 30s, who actually got involved in a scandal in the 30s here, she produced some topless dancers, Blaze Starr and Tempest Storm, and kind of became famous as a topless place.
Now, there's one classic I got to ask you about. Maybe classic, I need to use air quotes or something, because it wasn't necessarily in a good way, is Bob Stupak's Vegas World. You call it the strangest and most outlandish. What was so unusual about Stupak's Vegas World?
It had a space theme, and this was a place I went into as well a number of times in the 90s before it left. I don't know where he got these ideas, you know, where, you know, a plexiglass tube full of water that was bubbling, and then he would put a number of these up on the ceiling, so you'd walk by and you'd look up there and you'd see this water bubbling from these plexiglass containers. And you know, he had a space astronaut hanging from the ceiling, you know, and a a shuttlecraft. Even the carpet had planets on there, and then every few feet you walked by, it would say Bob Stupak's Vegas World. He had an enormous display case that he said had $1 million in it, and it did have some money in there, but he also had a lot of his casino chips that he would include in the addition for the $1 million. He had a slot machine there that where you play it and maybe win $1 million, but apparently nobody ever won it. He had the famous thing about I couldn't believe my eyes when he had this duck there that would play tic-tac-toe with you, and the duck would always win because it was first, so you'd put money in there, and then the duck would get the X in the middle, and then you're on your way to losing.
Yeah,
to the duck.
You can't win. One thing that I thought was interesting about this is that you count Las Vegas showgirls as a lost part of Las Vegas, despite Oscar Goodman's very best efforts to keep the tradition alive. So by your reckoning, in a book called Lost Las Vegas, what has happened to the Las Vegas showgirl?
Well, showgirls became very famous and associated with Las Vegas starting in the 40s, and it became a kind of a competitive thing. The Frontier was the first one to have it, have them, and they were a kind of a Western-style saloon girls. And then the El Rancho Vegas brought in the George Morrow dancers in the late 40s, about 49. And then you had Don Arden coming in 1950, and he became, to help out the Desert Inn, and he became the most famous showgirl choreographer. And then you had the Leader de Paris at the Stardust. There's a really nice picture of some showgirls on platforms suspended from the ceiling above diners in the Cafe Continental dining room at the Stardust in 1958. Really, I think they came to a head in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and they're not gone yet, but they're close to dying out. And we thought that would be a good thing to put in there to try to get across to people. Mm-hmm. This was one of the big things that made Las Vegas famous, and it's really not completely disappeared, but it's getting
it's
there.
It's fading away.
Yeah.
It's fading away. Jeff Burbank's latest book is called Lost Las Vegas. It's a collection of historic photos of Las Vegas, along with his explanations and notes of what they were and how they came to be built. Jeff Burbank will be signing copies of Lost Las Vegas tomorrow at noon at the Costco store in Henderson. Jeff, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Dave.